Rubini Macro Associates Chairman and CEO Nouriel Roubini sat down with Bloomberg's David Inglis at the Greenwich Economic Forum in Hong Kong on Monday. Roubini gave insights on the Iran war, oil shockwaves, and explained why he still does not see a US or global recession on the horizon. He also took a look at the global AI boom, which he says remains a powerful counterweight to stagflationary risks. Let's listen in.
Good morning, good almost afternoon. Thank you for joining us today. For those of you who flew in, thank you for taking the time. By the way, just as a note, so Kena, our wonderful MC today, used to be our former producer for the China show. So there we go, just the shout out. So I didn't prepare anything, any questions for today. And that's not for the lack of trying or just I woke up on the lazy side of bed today. Just being in the news business, this cycle has taught me to not prepare for anything. In fact, so going into the weekend, we were going into these big talks in Pakistan between the two sides. We were coming off, I think the best, Jim and I were just having this conversation. You know, emerging market stocks had their best week last week since the pandemic. So you have to go 6 years back to see the type of week equity markets had last week. And you were kind of thinking, was there too much downside? Did people buy in? Was NVIDIA trading at 20 times earnings, something that you never thought you'd see, but we did see, and was that part of it? And then we came out of the weekend, talks failed, and we were preparing our rundown for shows today. And as we went into the rundown looking to talk about failed talks, the U.S. then came out and said they were going to do a complete blockade of the Strait of Hormuz by 10 p.m. Eastern time Monday. So from the current time, that's about 10 hours from now. So we then had to scramble and figure out what we haven't had to talk about a naval blockade in this day and age. So we were just trying to figure out how to do that as well. That's just to say there are many moving parts, and I think We're dealing with scenarios now. And I think on that note, let me bring in, of course, famed economist. I have the pleasure of having chatted with this time last year on the same stage, Nouriel Roubini, of course. I don't know where to start. How do you think this ends?
Well, the honest truth is no one knows how it ends. As you pointed out, you can do only scenario analysis. You know, about 2 weeks ago, I wrote a piece and I said there are two options. One is de-escalation, and the other one is escalation. And the argument for de-escalation was that Israel and Trump made two mistakes at the beginning of the war. One, to believe that the initial decapitation of the leadership of the country would lead to regime collapse. Two, the belief that, like in June of last year, Iran will be either unwilling or unable to block the Strait of Hormuz and or damage the energy facilities of the GCC countries in the Gulf. Now, given those two mistakes, people said he's behind the poll, popularity is down, he's going to lose the midterm. He has to blink, he has to chicken out, again, taco, and he has to de-escalate. The problem with the de-escalation was that, you know, the two sides are so far apart that you cannot reach a deal. And if you don't reach a deal, then, and if you don't do anything else, what happens? Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz. Yes, the market rally because sign of relief. The war is in a ceasefire, but oil prices are going to be higher than otherwise. Iran is going to remain a permanent threat to any export and imports of energy or anything else in the Gulf. They're going to rebuild missiles. They're going to rebuild drones. They can even proliferate with a nuclear weapon and become a permanent threat. And the deterrence of the U.S. to credibly support his friends and allies, whether those in the Gulf or in Europe or look in Asia, how are you going to credibly deter China with your friends and allies like Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Taiwan, Australia, and you name it? So it's a strategic disaster. So my argument was that having done the mistake of starting the war, at this point it's better to escalate. Because if you do escalate and eventually you force the regime to surrender, you have a political win and also a geostrategic win. The risk of escalation is, of course, that you escalate and then becomes even worse and all prices go to 150, 200, because you're not able to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and the Iranians attack the energy facilities of the Gulf. And then you end up like in 1970s stagflation. I'm old enough to remember 1973 Yom Kippur War between Israel and Arab states, tripling of oil prices, or 1979 Islamic Revolution Iran, again, tripling of oil prices, and two nasty stagflationary recession in 74, 75, and 80, 82. But, you know, at this point, de-escalating means that you give a strategic win to Iran. So in my view, you have no option but to escalate and hope that if you escalate, eventually you win. Now, there are two ways of escalating. My view was that the way to make it effective was to literally send troops and take over Karg Island, send troops and take over the islands next to the Strait of Hormuz, try to open the Strait of Hormuz, try to protect your friends and allies with more Patriot missiles in the Gulf, and then strangle that way the regime. And every day you kill more of the leadership and so on. In 2 months, maybe you win. Maybe for 2 months, oil is at 120, 130, 140, but then they're forced to de facto surrender. Your de facto regime collapse. That would have been the right thing to do, but that implied putting troops on the ground. Instead, he doesn't want to put U.S. troops at risk, so he's doing the blockade. The problem with the blockade is that, yeah, you strangle most of the revenues of the regime. That's true. But you're not reopening the Strait of Hormuz, and they're going to control it. Actually, you're blocking it. You're saying nobody can get in and out of the Strait of Hormuz if it's Iranian-related. But the Iranians are not going to let anybody else to move in and out of the Strait either. So it's even worse than it is right now. No traffic. So you get a spike in oil prices. You're strangling financially the regime out of its oil and other revenues. That's true. But the regime has been shown willing to suffer even for years. Look at the decade-year war between Iran and Iraq. And if you strangle them, they're going to try to, again, to attack the other country, the GCC, their energy facilities, maybe even the east-west pipeline of the Saudis. And therefore, you're not resolving stuff. So if you want to escalate, you have to do it the hard way. Doing it the easy way is not going to work. And therefore, this form of escalation is going to be a tit-tat between the two, more spikes in oil prices, more problems, the regime doesn't collapse, and then we'll see what happens next.
In what form do you think the escalation will happen? Because the reason I ask you that is there's a big difference between troops on Karg Island and troops going into Tehran. And I can only imagine markets reacting quite negatively to both, but certainly a lot more so for the latter. And do you think in whatever escalation we will likely see, do you think that achieves a strategic objective on the part of the U.S.? And what is that strategic objective?
Well, I don't think you'll have troops on the ground on land, Iranian soil. I think that if you wanted to make an argument for escalation, you need troops on the ground on Karg Island to take it over and strangle the revenue of the regime. You need also troops on those islands that are next to the Strait of Hormuz to try to unblock it, demine it. Of course, they can still send rockets and drones, but you can try to block them, and you send enough Patriots, Arrow 2, TAD to the Gulf to try to protect them. So that's troops on the ground, certainly not going into Tehran. I think that combined strategy together with bombing day in, day out, Iran, Israel, and U.S. and killing more of the leadership in a couple of months is likely to lead to not regime collapse, but the regime surrender, because you strangle them economically, financially, militarily, and so on. I think that's a form of escalation that in the short run leads to oil prices being higher, stock markets being lower, bond yields being higher, but you get the job done. maybe it was a mistake to start this war, but leaving it midway this way is a strategic disaster, not just for Israel or the Gulf or the US, but also for Europe and China and Asia, because Iran controls Hormuz, because they decide forever who gets in, who gets out, and there'll be another wars of one sort or another. And they proliferate with nuclear bomb, with more missiles, with more drones. It's a nightmare. So maybe it was a bad idea to start the war, but conditional having started it, you have to finish the job. And finish the job means to have regime surrender. Instead, they don't want to do it this way because they don't put any troops even on the islands. So they're trying to achieve the same result of strangling the revenues of the regime by doing a blockade. If you do a blockade, you strangle them economically, but they're not going to surrender anytime soon. And if you don't restart the war by bombing the hell out of them, military infrastructure, killing more of the leadership of the country, trying to take over the island of Hormuz to try to demine it and open it up, then just a blockade by itself is a game of chicken, and it's a game of chicken that I think Iran eventually wins because they can suffer for a while there are political costs and economic costs of just trying the slow motion strangle of the regime. You know, it took decades for financial and trade sanctions, in Zimbabwe to eventually have a regime collapse. So economic, financial sanctions and blockades don't get you what you want to. Unfortunately, you have to do stuff that is more risky. You have to risk troops and you have people die. But if you're not willing to do it, they're not going to succeed. So I think it'll be a half-baked escalation, and then you don't achieve your results and we'll be in a worse world because you still have higher oil prices, you're going to have stock markets falling, bond yields higher, consumer business confidence falling, more growth slowdown globally, more higher inflation for longer, and you don't even achieve the results. So it's kind of like a half escalation. This is not the way to do it.
How does he, President Trump and his team, how do they deal with several fallouts? One is the relationship between the U.S. and its allies, not just in the Asia-Pacific, but across the world, who effectively are having to foot the economic bill of this war in the form of high prices, right? And you just have to look at, like, Bangladesh or the Philippines, which have no direct, even perhaps indirect involvement in the war, and that's even a stretch. How does the U.S. then come out of this, mend ties and trust with its allies across the world?
Well, as I said, ex-ante probably starting this war was a mistake, and there were a couple of strategic miscalculations. And because of that, and the spike in oil prices, growth will be lower, inflation will be higher, and the longer the war lasts, the longer Strait of Hormuz is blocked, the more there is damage done to the oil production or exports facilities of the Gulf, the more it will be the negative impact on growth and higher on inflation. And of course, the biggest victim is Asia, because for Asia, this is not just a price shock, but also quantity, because most of the 20% of energy from the Gulf goes to Asia. So at some point, there is really a production shock. In Europe, it's more of a price impact because they're net importer of oil, less of a quantity apart from some natural gas, but it's a significant impact in inflation and growth, less than for Asia. And of course, the U.S. being a net energy exporter, the terms of trade effect is positive, but it's still a negative because those who consume energy, households and firms are using energy, are worse off and they're going to spend less. While the energy producers in the U.S. are going to have a windfall gain and not going to produce and invest more. So you have some slowdown in growth even in the U.S. and some increase in inflation. And he had already poor popularity because of the affordability crisis. So even if the impact on growth and inflation is more modest than Europe and in Europe less than in Asia, still it looks unpopular. It looks like a war he has not won. So there is a damage done to friends and allies. Not just through this war, but his overall attitudes from the Western Hemisphere to what he does in Europe, to how he deals with Asia. Even if in Asia it becomes slightly more constructive with China, maybe because China had him with the chokehold of critical minerals. So at least with China, there was something of a defrosting of relationship. But my point is that given the damage you've done overall to your relationship with different types of friends and allies, whether it's in Western Hemisphere or in Europe or Middle East or in Asia, one, you have to maintain your credibility and deterrence against foes, whether it's China or Russia or North Korea or Iran. And if you want to credibly say, I'm going to support my allies, once you have started the war, you have to finish the job, even if finishing the job implies a significant economic and military and even troops dying cost. But you have to take that risk. If you don't take it, then you have lost. If you de-escalate or you half-escalate, but not in a way that leads to regime surrender. And in my view, escalate in the full way and trying to have regime surrender is not just good for the US or Israel or the Gulf. Actually, the biggest beneficiaries are going to be China and Asia, because most of the oil from the Gulf goes to China and Asia. And being in a situation which right now Iran has a chokehold on that oil, and any time in the future, you know, they're going to rebuild their weapons, they're going to strangle, they're going to get tolls and whatever not, is something that is not acceptable, not just to Israel or the Gulf or US, should not be acceptable to China or to Hong Kong or to Japan or India or anybody in Asia, because those are the biggest victims actually of having an Iran that is a rogue state, the threat, and it's not just the Strait of Hormuz. They have the Houthis can block also the other Strait of Bab el-Mandab, like they did during the war between Israel and Hamas. So, you know, any civilized country in the world should not want a situation which a country is a rogue, radical, extremist, fanatic regime that's been not just a curse to his own people for the last 47 years, as a chokehold on 20% of the energy in the world. That should not be acceptable to anybody, and it should be in everybody's interest to make sure that doesn't happen.
So let's say they do succeed. Where does this leave Iran's relationship, assuming we do get some form of regime change, its relationship with its GCC neighbors, because they've been just bombing each other as well?
You know, I mean, I don't know if there'll be a real regime change. You know, many people in Iran would like a total regime collapse and some form of democracy. Some people like the return of the monarchy with the crown prince and so on. But in my view, that's probably unlikely. But I would say between the current regime, by the way, this current regime right now is even more radical than the one run by Khamenei's father, because his son is actually more crazy. He's more of a lunatic, more of a radical, and our factions are even more extremist, you could say because of what Israel and U.S. have done. But these guys are now in power, and they've used now the weapons of blocking Hormuz, of bombing energy facilities of the Gulf. Even if Saudi said, you know, I'm neutral, and they try to engage Iran in negotiation and a diplomatic relationship opened by China, all that meant nothing. Once the war started, the Iranians went after Saudi, after Oman, after Kuwait, after Bahrain, after even Qatar, after anybody, after Turkey, after Cyprus, and so on. And by the way, their ballistic missiles, 4,000 kilometers, can reach anywhere of the European Union as well. So these are threats to not just to Israel or the Gulf, but also to all of the European kind of union. So you have a regime that is even more radical than before, and now they've effectively taken over a major source, a key source of something. It's like as if a rogue regime, totally rogue, were to take over the Strait of Malacca and say, hey, China, anything that is your import or exports cannot pass from there anymore. I mean, would that be acceptable? Is the equivalent of something of that sort. So my point is, in one extreme, you have pure democracy and freedom. But, you know, there are many regimes that are autocratic. I mean, these people have been a curse to their own people, because by following Islamic fundamentalists for the last 47 years having sanctions, have forgone $1 trillion of oil revenues. I mean, Iran is a country that has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia. It's a country that has scientists, engineers, doctors, and you name it. It's a country that would even follow its own national interests and would have an autocrat. I'm not speaking about the Democrat. If you had a Sisi like in Egypt or any other benevolent autocrat, a strong man or woman, for what that matters, that says my national interest is not to antagonize the world. Stop saying after 47 years, debt to America, debt to Israel. My national interest is to engage with the world and open up to the world and eliminate the sanctions. I can be still nationalistic. I can still defend my interests. But this anti-Western policy has been a curse and is a benefit only to a small clique of an elite of fanatic Islamists and revolutionary guards who are economically and financially, like the narco-trafficker of Venezuela, benefiting from here. It's been a curse to 90 million Iranians and exporting, revolutions and imperialism around the Middle East. I mean, look at the Middle East. You have a bunch of failed states. You know, Lebanon is a failed state. Libya is a failed state. Syria is a failed state. Iraq is a failed state. Yemen is a failed state. Sudan, Somalia, Afghanistan. And most of them is because the Iranians and through their proxies have tried to expand Shia and fanaticism throughout the Middle East. There's no other region in the world in which you have a dozen of failed states. And that's a threat, this situation, to everybody. It's not just an Iran issue. You have a situation which major countries, some of them actually major producers even of energy, some of them are like Libya, Iran, Iraq, have tons of energy. And because they're run by a bunch of fundamentalists, have not even been able to do bad, good for their own sake. So it should be in the global interest to make sure that this particular regime is neutralized. And I don't care whether it's a Democrat or whether it's an autocrat, but benevolent. There are plenty of benevolent autocrats in Asia and in the Middle East. They were caring about national interests of their own country and having civilized relationship with the rest of the world. This regime has to be either collapse or surrender, because the alternative is a nightmare for the world for the long run. Market, yes, they rallied. Once there was a ceasefire, stock market went up 7-8% all over Asia. Oil fell below 100, bond yields rallied and so on. But it didn't last because we knew, or at least I knew, this negotiation are going to lead to a deal. And Iran at this point knows that there's leverage. And these fanatics are going to use all this leverage for the long run. And that should not be acceptable to anybody. So even if we didn't like what the U.S. and Israel has done, should be never the interest to finish the job and lead them to de facto surrender. And then if it's an autocrat, it's in power, so be it. Certainly it's much better than the current situation for the Iranians and for the Middle East and for the world.
I think there's no way to segue inflation now, but I'll do it anyway. So assuming we do get that off-ramp, assuming the objectives are met, we still have to deal with what is increasingly now looking like a very long tail of economic fallout on the back of this. Several questions. I think the U.S. economy, what is your assessment of how and when this shows up in the U.S. economy in the coming months? And what does the Fed do about that?
Well, I would say, you know, the impact both on growth and inflation is the least for the United States and for net energy exporters. Or just a week ago in Brazil, for example. It's bigger for regions like Europe where you are net energy importers, so the terms of trade impact is significantly negative. So the impact on higher inflation, lower growth in Europe and the Eurozone is going to be bigger. And the biggest impact in terms of both inflation and growth is going to be on Asia. But even in the United States, I would say there'll be some slowdown of growth, some pickup in inflation. Now, how much slowdown of growth and how much inflation depends on whether you either fully de-escalate and accept this ceasefire. And with this ceasefire, oil prices will never go back to what they were before the war, because there'll be a risk premium, because Iran effectively has a chokehold on the Gulf. So oil will be more like in the 80s
What's the floor? What's the floor, you think, on oil? Where do you think we will see the average floor for oil?
If you have the escalation without the deal and the Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz, and given the damage and all everything else, I think oil can go towards 80 plus. It's not going to go back to 60. So there is some impact on global inflation, some impact on global growth. You don't get a global recession. You don't get a sustained increase in inflation because it becomes a price level effect with temporary increase in inflation for a while. So it's an economic damage and it's a medium long term essentially negative impact on the world. But we avoid a recession and significant de-anchoring of inflation and inflation expectation, even if the impact, as I said, stronger in Asia, middle in Europe, and the least in the United States. You know, the U.S. actually, before this war, last year when there were the April 2nd tariff, I said, we're not going to have a U.S. and global recession, even if everybody on the sell side said so, because I knew that the market will force him to chicken out. You know, tariff went from 3 to 30%, but today they're 14 because, you know, 2 weeks into April 2nd, S&P was down 15%, NASDAQ 20, bond yields were up 80 basis points, high yield spreads were up 150, and dollar started to free fall. And that's when Scott Bessent went to Mar-a-Lago, told the president, I told you, if you do this, the market is going to punish you, you're going to have a recession, you're going to lose the midterm, and MAGA is dead on arrival. Mr. President, you want to double down or you want to blink and go chicken out? And the president, who is impulsive but not totally irrational, decided to blink. And now, you know, is it ideal to have an averaging tariff of 14% rather than 3%? Of course not. But does it lead to a US global recession? Of course not. That's why I said we're not going to have a US and global recession. The impact will be some slowdown in growth, some increase in inflation, but moderate. And this year before the war, actually, there were more tailwinds than headwinds to US and global growth. Because in US, you had monetary easing. You had still fiscal stimulus in the pipeline. Because the cuts were after the midterm. You had the Fed having cut rates. You had easing of financial condition because stock market went higher last year. Bond yield fell. Credit spreads narrowed. And the weakening of the dollar benefited the net exports. And consumer and business confidence were strong. And you had this massive secular tailwind from the AI boom. In my view, it's not a bubble. It's really a long-term secular boom. It's going to lead to much higher potential growth. U.S. potential growth can go from 2 to 4% by the end of this decade. So, you know, those strong fundamentals were there. And therefore, the war becomes a bit of a hiccup as long as it doesn't last too long. But if it were to be severe kind of a worsening of it for many more months, then, of course, the economic damage for a while could be more significant even for the United States. But by baseline, is not a U.S. Or a global recession, nor a very massive surge of inflation. So U.S. among all advanced economies, or even among them, is a much more better fundamental condition because of the strength of the AI and the technology boom and increasing productivity growth and all the other things that are coming out of it.
The U.S. president's trip to Beijing got postponed several weeks because of, obviously, events in the war in the Middle East. There is one that's scheduled to come up mid-May between Donald Trump is coming to meet President Xi Jinping. Can we look at that date on the calendar as almost a deadline for Trump to finish the job? Like, does he... I guess in some ways, is that incentive enough to make sure things are orderly ahead of arguably a more crucial conversation between those two?
No, I don't think this conflict is going to be over by mid-May when they're set to meet up. Certainly this half-baked escalation with the blockade could last for many months, and then the Iranians are going to respond by lots of other things they're going to do to hurt the Gulf producers and so on and so on. And then maybe they start attacking Israel again. And then maybe U.S., the ceasefire completely collapses. So I think that once you create a blockade, the idea that it's just a blockade and the ceasefire remains, I think is highly unlikely. Then the military escalation across the board is becoming more likely. And if you fully escalate the way I would have done it, it would have still taken maybe 2 or 3 months of really heavy escalation until the regime surrenders. With half-baked escalation, there's no way you achieve your goals by mid-May. So either you postpone again the meeting with Xi Jinping or you go there, but then, it's not going to be a very productive meeting, because before the war, he knew that, you know, the Chinese had the threat of critical minerals, and therefore he decided, okay, I'm going to re-engage them and try to have some strategic understanding that reduces for the time being the tensions and so on. Now all of this is off rail, and the Chinese might actually think of the U.S. Having created this war also as a way of strangling them. And if you do it, by the way, the blockade, pretty much all of the oil that comes from Iran, not all of the oil, it goes to Asia, but certainly, actually, most of the Iranian oil goes to China, while most of the oil and energy from the Gulf goes to Asia. And therefore, if you do a blockade, until now, even during the war, the U.S. was not preventing the Iranian ships to get out of Hormuz and bring the oil to China. Now with the blockade, you don't allow that anymore. Mm. So you're actually creating something, this further economic damage to China, pisses off the Chinese, and the Chinese are going to say, what the hell? So it's not a very constructive way to go to Beijing and try to engage if you're doing that. So might as well postpone further a summit rather than make it a failure. And the Chinese, on one side, are happy because they're saying, the cover of The Economist this week saying, you never interrupt your enemy while he's making a strategic mistake. So that's one of the attitudes of the Chinese. U.S. Made their own self-goal, so let them rot, and so on. And they've lost their credibility, they've lost their deterrence. Their weapons are going to the Middle East rather than being deployed in Asia, and this and that. But on the other side, a U.S. and a Trump that is a wild card is also something that the Chinese are not very comfortable either, so they must have mixed feelings about them. I mean, some people in Beijing think that, you know, that actually a weakened Trump is bad for them, because Trump was more willing than some of the hawks, because a whole bunch of hawks in the administration were really China hawks, and he has put them aside because he decided, okay, I'm going to try to re-engage with China. So if Trump becomes too weak, they worry that the Mark Rubios of the world or others that are hawkish, like even J.D. Vance on China, may have the upper hand. So a very weak Trump is not actually in their benefit either. Mm. So it's a mixed bag for the Chinese, what's going on with the U.S.
The quiet and peaceful days of global tariffs of last year. Let me rephrase that. Is Donald Trump the best thing to happen to China recently?
I don't know. Some people say, probably have a view in China, as I said, your strategic competitor is shooting itself in the foot, is pissing off allies all over the world, is starting trade wars. He looks like actually hot war warrior, and is destroying both the soft power of the U.S. and even some of the hard power of the United States. So let him do it, and we're going to engage the world with trade agreements by showing that we're actually responsible stakeholder. We don't start war. We're not imperialist and whatever not. So that's the argument of why. You know, it's good for them. But this is also a Trump that actually, compared to even the Biden administration that care about human rights and other things happening all over Asia and China and so on, is ignoring that stuff. And yeah, imposed the tariff, but then he chickened out. And now, being a dealer, he wants to do a deal with China, while within the U.S. there are many, both in Congress and even among his advisors, that are much more hawkish. They're believers that, you know, you have to credibly deter China, you have to have a much more muscular approach. You have to impose more restriction on technology and other stuff, more support of your friends and allies, a much more, how to say, containment approach to China. And therefore, you know, if Trump is weak, as I said, the hawks might actually raise their heads. So, but, you know, the U.S. has also shown, in spite of not winning this war, that from a military point of view, it's a very, very powerful country with very, very powerful weapons. And being able to, you know, the whole approach of China was, you know, we can go and by using missiles, we can destroy their navy, their aircraft carriers and this and that if they get too close to us. Well, what the U.S. has successfully done is that by having aircraft carriers that are in the Indian Ocean, but having very precision missiles, being able to really damage in a very, very precise way lots of military targets. When there was Desert Storm against Iraq 20 years ago, 90% of the missiles were not precision guided and would end up either killing lots of civilians or not even hitting their own target. In this case, almost 90% of all these Israeli and U.S. missiles, because we have now the drone technology and we have the, you know, the information coming from satellites, the intelligence and the ballistic missiles and the drone, whatever, it's a much more targeted and a successful way. Right. So, and the Iranians have not been able to attack any of the Navy weapons of the United States. So if there was a confrontation, say, in Asia, U.S. can keep his aircraft carriers, and he has 11 groups of them, far away from China, and still launch lots of stuff that can damage China or can protect and defend Taiwan. And this war is one of the first one. I mean, the first one was, of course, the Ukraine-Russia war that suggested that now defense tech is the way of doing war. And who's the expert at defense tech? Ukrainians, because they learned it. The Russian, because they learned it. Israel. And now the United States. The United States is more advanced than anybody else. And I don't think in defense tech the Chinese are as far as the U.S. So they have to rethink what the confrontation over Taiwan becomes. And U.S. has shown that they can do a lot while protecting their own assets. So that's another dimension that could be
Yeah. Mind. Well, a lot of the accuracy that these military weapons have gained since Desert Storm was down to, and here's the segue to AI, was because of semiconductors and just the advancements in chip technology literally in those missiles. That's a final question, and we're barely getting to, we're at the end, but yep. Just your thoughts on something that's managed to happen silently but steadily and consistently while this war of the last 7 weeks was taking place. Is AI has continued to drive markets. An example of that, today as I speak, I haven't checked my phone in about 30 minutes, but the Taiwan markets are at all-time highs as we speak. What are your thoughts? And how is also this the AI story in the Asia-Pacific resonating where you are based in the U.S.?
You know, I used to be, unquote, Dr. Doom, worried all about the financial crisis and
mega threats.
And some people say you become Dr. Boom because I do believe actually that it's not just AI. There are about 15 different technologies of the future. It's AI, semiconductors, robotic automation, humanoid robots, defense tech, quantum, fusion, green tech, fintech, ag tech, new material science, commercial, space exploration, commercialization, you name it. These are a Cambrian explosion of new technology of the future, like we're not seen in human history. And the two big innovators are on one side US and then China. And then there are pockets of innovation in Asia, like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, India, Israel, some things in Europe. But my view is that US potential growth is already above 2%, closer to 3%. And by the end of the decade, regardless of this war, regardless who's in power, in Washington, doesn't matter. The dynamics of the U.S. private sector is such that potential growth in the U.S. is going to be 4%. And then after that, by 2040, 6%. And then by 2050, 10%. And the other big beneficiary of this innovation is going to be China. And it's not the zero-sum game. We win, they lose, or vice versa. Because many of these technologies are general-purpose technologies, and you learn from each other. So those who innovate get most of the benefits. Those who adopt the technology still benefit from adoption, and those who don't adopt, then they don't survive. So that fundamental story, regardless of geopolitics, regardless of climate change, regardless of populism, is the driver for the next 10, 20 years, is a positive for the world at large, certainly positive for both US and China. And that remains true, and that's why even at the peak of the war, the S&P was down 4%, and now markets are rallying, and the AI story is not a fad, is not a bubble, is going to last, and it's not the AI. And in these 15 industries of the future, you can debate for, as much as you want whether US ahead or China in which one of them. The reality is both of them are doing well in most of them. Some of them ahead in some of them in other. But both of them are going to benefit and everybody else is going to follow up. So that's a big story, that there is a strong, positive aggregate supply shock that increases growth and reduces inflation. This is a secular boom driven by technology. And then you have all the shocks that are negative aggregate supply shocks, that are stagflationary, war, oil shocks, Middle East, aging of population, populism, pandemics, climate change, you name it. But since April 2nd, I've said tech trumps tariffs, because the impact of tech is 200 basis points increase in potential growth, while the impact of all the trade, the migration, and other things, circulation, only 50 basis points. So it's a ratio 4-1. But they also said tech trumps temper tantrums too, because there's a wide range of things. It doesn't look like crazy, but one, market discipline, two, technological innovation, make sure that these are second order. Once, during a speech, I made a joke. I said, it doesn't matter who's president of the United States. You could have Mickey Mouse, president of the United States. And the dynamism of the U.S. private sector is such, U.S. is going to do great, even if Mickey Mouse was president, let alone Donald Trump. It was a joke. People made it a headline for an article saying, Nuriel says that even if Mickey Mouse was president, U.S. will do well. But I think that's true. And same thing for China. U.S. and China are going to do well. So we're on the verge of a secular boom with massive aggregate, positive aggregate supply shocks for the long term. And then in the short term, you have a dozen different types of stagflationary shocks that are the opposite, negative aggregate supply shocks, reduce growth and cause inflation. So there's a tug of war between the two. Right. I think eventually technology dominates over the medium term, but we can cause a lot of damage in the short run by doing lots of stupid things.
We started out with somewhat Dr. Doom. I think we got a version of Dr. Boom at the end there.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rubini. That's all we have time for. Thank you.
That was Nuriel Rubini, Chairman and CEO of Rubini Macro Associates, speaking to Bloomberg's David Inglis at the Greenwich Economic Forum in Hong Kong. I'm Patrick Kidd for BizNews.com.